Last week was an introductory lecture to our subject, Who is Jesus? And my goal was to try to highlight the importance of knowing the real Jesus. That was the subject. And the three main points that we dwelt on in the night was that at the time, Jesus gave meaning to people's lives. So maybe if we knew him, he could give meaning to ours. That was the first major point we covered. Secondly, that at the time, Jesus gave meaning to people's lives because of the quality of his love. So maybe we need to know a bit about love too. And if we know something of Jesus, we might find a way forward ourselves. And the third point, which was the one we spent most of the night on, was that, yes, he gave meaning to our lives and he loved us, but the key element from the data that we've got is that the meaning he gave went right to the very depths of people's religious perceptions. He opened up a way to God. He spoke of God. He revealed the face of God, the words of God. He took people at their deepest religious yearnings and somehow made sense of that. Tonight's lecture is to open up for you. It'll be a difficult lecture, I hope, because we're going into quite important matter, and I wouldn't be surprised if you've got questions stored away that will need to come out in half break that we take. But whatever the difficulty, let's fire into it. Our first and major source, then, is the New Testament, and we'll now spend some 45 minutes on that. And I want to mention a few things first. There are mentions of Jesus, and I have some references for you there, in Josephus, a Jewish historian of the day who wrote a thing called The Antiquities of the Jews. He has one small reference to Jesus in there when he's talking about the murder of James, the brother of the Lord, actually. He mentions Jesus there. Suetonius is a Latin historian who wrote the lives of various emperors and the life of Claudius and the life of Nero. He alludes to Jesus when it becomes, he's talking about the Christians in Rome. The most important non-New Testament text is from Tacitus, his Annals, book 15. Chapter 44, and then 2 to 8 verses there, or the sections, where he has a number of things to talk about Jesus, basically that he existed and that he was murdered under Pontius Pilate or crucified, that he started this movement in Palestine and so on. But there's very little in all of that. If we just relied on the non-New Testament literature at the time, we'd hardly know Jesus existed. We'd know that, but that's all. One reason for that, I think, is really important just to alert you to, it's obvious one said, is that the New Testament was so precious that it was treasured, translated rapidly into a whole lot of different languages, and so we're able to restore it quite readily. Whereas a lot of the other histories that we know about, the Jewish histories and, for example, Tacitus, books 7 to 10 of Tacitus's annals are not extant. They're lost. And they include the whole period of Judea under Tiberius and Caligula, which would have been fascinating history had we had it. We can't presume what was in it, but it doesn't exist anymore. And there are other, we know about them because secondhand we know they're written. There's enormously long Jewish histories written at the time, which none of which is left. We just haven't got it anymore. So what we would have had all that been preserved is anyone's guess. But it's worth keeping in mind that the miracle is that we have so much about Jesus. And the reason is because of the impression he made, and the New Testament's text was so cherished that it was carefully preserved. So that, in effect, our only source, apart from minor bits and pieces, is the New Testament. But I want to say some things about it. Firstly, the New Testament is a most trustworthy document from a historian's point of view. Not all would admit this. I want to make the statement, though, and I hope establish it for your satisfaction. History is what? History is not the compilation of raw data. You can do that in a computer, A machine can do it. You can store up a whole lot of what we'll call facts, data. That's not history, surely. History is an art, and it is the art of discovering and conveying the significance of events. You did a million things today, all of you, some unconscious and some subconscious. There's things happening all through the world from all different angles all the time. The historian is the one, and it's quite a beautiful and intelligent art, who can perceive the movement of events and can somehow select the data and focus it and shape it to show the interconnections between this and that to get the flow of history from a point of view, of course. You can't do anything except from our point of view. A good historian will have a significant point of view that other people will recognize, that gives them insight and some kind of truthful appreciation of the movement. A bad historian will either be so trivial that no one thinks it's worth listening to, or he'll miss the point of the movement, and scholars generally will ignore his point of view as saying that, well, he's missed out on this and missed out on that and so on. So I'm trying to say a simple thing to remind you that that's what history is. It's data, yes, but it's data from the point of view of the significance of what happened, of the events and the words and the actions. Now, when we come to the New Testament, then, looking at from that point of view, it's very clear from what we know that those who wrote it intended it to be history. They were interested in events. They were interested in Jesus. They were interested in the real Jesus and what he said and did, and they were interested in communicating the significance of Jesus as they had come to see it. One of our earliest documents, just to give you an example, is taken from a man called Papias, who was a bishop in a place called Hierapolis, which is in modern western Turkey, not far from Ephesus, if you know your geography of the ancient world. And early in the second century, he is recorded as, well, he wrote this, but our record is from a later document from the third century, Eusebius, from his History of the Church. And this is the record. He said, when Mark became Peter's interpreter, he wrote down accurately, though not in order, all that he remembered of what the Lord had said or done. For he, that is Mark, had not heard or followed the Lord, but later, as I heard, Peter, who used to adapt his teaching to the needs of the time, without making any sort of arrangement of the Lord's oracles. Consequently, Mark made no mistake in thus writing down certain things as he remembered them, for he was careful not to omit or falsify anything of what he'd heard. Now, in itself, that doesn't substantiate a lot, but what it does substantiate is that Papias, second generation only, was himself sharing the thought that he knew that this Mark wanted to write history. He was interested in putting down what he'd heard from Peter, the memoirs of Peter. There's a statement in Justin Martyr that's similar, which I won't read to you. If you read Luke's gospel itself, you can get an indication from his very first words that Luke certainly intended to write about events and intended to communicate their significance. He says here, chapter 1 of his gospel, seeing that many others have undertaken to draw up accounts of the events that have taken place among us, exactly as these were handed down to us by those who from the outset were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, I, in my turn, after carefully going over the whole story from the beginning, have decided to write an ordered account for you, Theophilus, so that your excellency may learn how well-founded is the teaching that you have received. The end of John's Gospel, you might recall his last words, many other things Jesus said and did, but if we could not fit them, if books were written, we could not fit them in, he says. In his letter, he says, what we're talking about to you is what we've seen and heard and watched and handled with our hands. So we're talking, in other words, when we look at the New Testament, about history. But my second point is important. History in the first century was not written with the same criteria that history is written today. And the key difference, as far as I'm able to understand it, is this. History then and now has the same goal, but the literary form was different. Today we demand for history that the data which is interpreted by the historian be presented in as cold, hard, simple, unadorned, unimaginative language as possible, and the sources located as much as they can be, so that the raw data is presented, whether it be a photo or a statement from a speech made by some person on D-Day 1944, whatever, the raw data is presented, and then the historian weaves all that data into a pattern which creates his portrait, which is his artistic presentation of history. We have other literary forms for more imaginative dealing with the subject. We can have drama on a stage, and we allow a different... You can still be talking about real events on the stage and real people, but you're allowed much more play, aren't you, imaginatively. You can write poetry, you can write music, and all of them are attempts to communicate some truth, but we can allow ourselves a fictional approach even in all kinds of ways today, but when we get to history, we demand a literary form that's very tight in its presentation. Not so in the first century. They weren't allowed, it wasn't fiction, history, they weren't allowed to imagine things. They weren't allowed to create their own thoughts. They had to be concerned with real events. They had to be, oh, it wasn't history otherwise. But when they presented that real event, they were able and expected to present it in the most delightful, powerful, imaginative, provocative, convincing way, so long as what they were communicating was the truth as they saw it. Do you kind of follow me there? They were allowed to, because they belonged, most of them, to a much closer than I am, to an oral tradition, where truth was told in story, where they spoke to the imagination as well as the intellect. They didn't have our divided components that fairly clearly, and well, it's an important thing we've done, differentiate the different levels of consciousness. They spoke to the whole person, and of course if you want to communicate any truth to another human being, well, I can see myself now waving my hands and dancing around them, you do a lot more than just give the intellectual data usually. If you want to communicate about a person, you'll particularly want to do it. And so the New Testament, and I say this, it'll come back again and again, but it's basically important. I'm convinced and satisfied, convinced that we're dealing with a marvellous historical document. But you must read it with your imagination. And you must read it with your whole body and whole psyche, ready to let the truth that they're trying to communicate to you flow over you in a very large, on a very large stage. For example, Mark's Gospel, I just read you there from Papias. Mark's Gospel, the earliest of the Gospels, is said to be there, and traditionally, the Gospel of Peter. So Peter's memories are behind it. Well, obviously, Peter would have treasured Jesus' words. I mean, Jesus would have spoken, because they worked on memory then much more than you or I do today. Many of them couldn't read and write, obviously. So their memories were highly developed. And if Jesus had something to say that was, and let's presume he spoke beautifully, and he spoke, it seems, in these two-line kind of poetic rhyming style, which was very memorable stuff that the prophets spoke in, things like, it is not the man who seeks his life that finds it, but the one who gives his life away that finds it, you know. A man who seeks his life will waste it, the one who wastes it will little. He spoke in those kind of punchy, paradoxical, imaginative and strong ways. They would have been burned into the mind of Peter or Andrew or James and John. They would have relished them. And surely when Peter came to talk, he'd have, like you have, memories of what your mother might have said to you or your father or a friend on a there held because those are still because they really gave you insight. That would have been their experience, obviously. And when Peter was sharing it with Mark, he wasn't going to say, well, like some people say to you, you know, when you've said something fairly well, you're thinking someone says, well, what you mean to say is, you know. You can imagine Peter saying, well, Jesus, look, perhaps if you put it this way, they might get a bit better. Well, maybe, but on the whole, I think Jesus would have said it pretty well. And Peter wouldn't have been wanting to improve it. He would have been wanting to relish it and hand it on. So that would have all been happening when it was appropriate. But let me say a fairly obvious thing to you, but take you through a small process here. Since we're dealing with history, Peter isn't just telling Mark everything Jesus did and said without insight. Peter is telling Mark, and Mark is telling us, things that Peter came to see towards the end of his life. Words that Jesus spoke when he first met Peter, and Peter remembered them all right. But you know what it's like when you remember a word maybe your mother told you, and now that you've been through and had your own kids and grown up or something, you start to realise the wisdom that was in the word that you never really knew then. Peter was trying to share with Mark all that he'd come to see as a result of his whole life, and his reflections, and the being in the agony in the garden made sense of things Jesus said back in Galilee. And he was trying to capture the inner meaning and the feeling and what Jesus was actually saying to him. And sometimes, isn't this true, sometimes the words capture all that and you can just put the words out and just arrange them so that people might get the meaning. But sometimes, and I think this is fairly obvious, especially if you've moved out of your own culture and you're trying to speak to people as Mark is, writing in Rome 35 years after Jesus' death, what Jesus said to farmers and fishermen in Galilee is one thing, and if Jesus was a good teacher, and he was, he'd be using their idiom, their language, their imagination, won't he, to communicate what he wants to say. What's Peter going to do when he's talking in Rome to people who speak Greek and come from a city? Is he going to use the same images all the time, the same words? To say what Jesus said, he may well have to use words to communicate the meaning truthfully that are different. First of all, he's got to translate, which is a big step anyhow. Secondly, he's not only translating words, he's translating ideas, he's translating feeling and meanings. And so, I think what I'm saying is terribly obvious now that I find myself saying it, we're not going to be always sure that every word spoken by Jesus in the Gospel in English, which goes back to the Greek, is going to be a word-by-word statement of what Jesus actually said, as though you got it off a tape recorder. But because it's history, and because it was accepted by the church as authentic with regard to Jesus, we can be sure that the Jesus presented there is the real Jesus. That we've got the real mind, the real heart, the real interests, the real aims, the real perceptions, as it were, of the real Jesus. That rather, perhaps giving it to you in one hit might be too much, but I think I can go through it fairly slowly, and I hope convincingly with you. In other words, I'll use an image that might hold this for you, and I see it as really vital. Jesus of Nazareth, we're starting from the bottom here. Jesus of Nazareth is what it's all about, and what he really did and what he really said. And Mary of Magdala wasn't interested in what people thought he should have said. She heard the words, and that's what made the difference. And they saw what he actually did on the lake, not what people might have liked him to do. It was the real Jesus that affected people. And had there been a tape recorder there, we could have had a tape recording of it. And had there been photographs at the time, we could have had photos of, there was Jesus holding my little kid when the disciples said to go away. He was in there getting a cuddle. And Mum's treasuring that photo till she dies. But there weren't tape recorders and there weren't photos. In a way, a lot of me's kind of glad, but that's another matter. But let's think through this, see if this make sense to you. Jesus didn't write the gospel. Mark wrote it. So, let me say something really simple to you. Forget our tape recorders. What I'm saying and what you hear are not identical. Hopefully there's a relationship, or you're living a little psychedelic dream of your own, and you're welcome to. Hopefully what I'm saying has something to do with what you're hearing, but I mean, it's, once I say it, you'll agree, everyone in the room's hearing something a bit different, because you're all selecting. You're not dead, lifeless, accurate tape recorders. You're human beings with your own thoughts, memories, dreams, selective processes, and some things are striking some and some things another. Mark wrote the gospel, not Jesus. So what we've got in the gospel is not what Jesus said, but what Peter heard. You got me? Not just Peter either, Peter and the community. So, in other words, we've got an indirect thing to Jesus. We've got what was revealed. Nothing is revealed unless someone sees something. It's what Peter saw and heard that he told Mark. And that's what we've got. And it's very precious. He came to understand, too, about Jesus. And then he handed on that understanding as he lived through his life, while Jesus was alive and after he died. He kept reflecting back on what Jesus said and what Jesus did. And as he read his Bible here, when he sat in a synagogue on a Friday night or something, he'd be pondering through, and he'd read through the Book of Wisdom, and he'd read Samuel, and he'd go through Exodus. And as he, just like you do, and as he read it, he'd be thinking of Jesus. And he'd find the words there to say it, huh? He'd find in there the poetic images that belonged to his people. He'd find powerful stuff about Moses being on the mountain, and the thunder and the lightning and the radiant whiteness of prayer. And so he'd say, oh, what a good way of putting it. You know? And he kind of, when he wanted to talk about Jesus in the transfiguration, he'd find the words, and you can find them there. And when he thought of the baptism, he'd go back to the image of the dove and the spirit. And the, do you see what I'm trying to get at? He called on his literary past, because it gave him the words to say what he saw, not always with his eyes, but with his heart, with his mind, with his feelings, with his body, with his whole life experience, what he came to understand. And that understanding that, let's say, Peter came to, he expressed in the way he sat, the way he talked, the way he smiled, the way he organized the community, the way he lived his liturgy and the way they shared things in common, and he also expressed it in his preaching and his teaching and so on, and finally up here in the gospel itself. And my image for the gospel, I hope it helps you, it seems to me the most truthful one I get, is it's the difference between a photo and a portrait. When you go through the New Testament, the letters of Paul are just letters of Paul, they're not portraits. That's Paul writing them, so you can know what Paul thought, as long as you know their letters and go back and study them. You can know what he felt, because they're there. You can work through the writing to that. But we haven't got anything Jesus wrote. We can't directly get to Jesus' thoughts and feelings. What we get to is the painting. The portrait that Mark, with Peter's guidance, made of Jesus. And if you think of that, when I think of it anyway, I find that incredibly beautiful, really. Because if you love someone really deep, you just think of the person you love most. And if that person's anything like Jesus, good luck to you. You do them well. Imagine it was Jesus' person that you loved most. And you did a portrait of him. You were, let's presume you were an artist of first caliber, and Mark is, under the inspiration of God. And you painted this beautiful portrait of that person, and I came to look at it. Say alternatively, you had a photo of that person that you'd taken 40 years ago by a river or something like that, and ask you to reflect on this and see if your reflections are like mine. The problem with photos is this, that if I take a photo, I don't take them, but if I did take a photo, and if I really liked it, I bet I know why, because the photo reminds me, it shows me what the camera picked up at that second, but it reminds me of the person, of how I felt on the day, of how we'd organized, how we'd all got together and had this terrific day out there, and someone caught a crab, and the whole damn thing was going real well, and I was feeling great that night, and so on, you know? And babies would be, and you got this, all your memories flood back, and they're all, this photo captures them and holds them for you. But if you weren't there, if you've got no memories about that occasion, no feelings, all you see when I look at your photos, unless I love you in a particular way and it does things for me, but just take a photo. You know, it's like when someone's gone overseas and says, there's me on Capitol Hill, and there's me in London, and there's me in the thing, and you've got to, like, they're fairly hard to take in a way because you've got nothing to, you've got a picture with no meaning for you. Had the Gospels been just photos of Jesus, words of Jesus, everything just, words perhaps richer, but words even, out of context, can be flat, can't they? The words you remember that people spoke to you have a context and have a feeling. And the way he said it is quite as much as important as what he said. He might have just said, I love you. Well, God, millions of people have said that all over the world. But when he said it, or she said it, in that context, you didn't forget. Because of the everything else that was involved. And if you said, as the climax of your great autobiography, and he said, I love you, or someone would have said, you better write it again, mate, because that's not going to convince anybody. You better, you know, do it better than that. You better, otherwise you won't communicate what happened on that day. So, sorry to get a bit wrapped up there. Because of the style of New Testament writing too, we have to allow the imagery to communicate to us. I found only a week ago or 2 weeks ago now, I was reading, and I'll read it to you now, John Henry Newman. And when you've got ideas and you suddenly find someone in 1833 has them, I found this most, very encouraging. And I'll read it to you. It's a book he wrote in 1833, Cardinal Newman, the name may be familiar to you, in a book called Arians in the Fourth Century. It's in Chapter 1, Section 3, Paragraph 3. And it is a whole long section, but I'll just read it to you. And he says, when the mind is occupied by some vast and awful subject of contemplation, it is prompted to give utterance to its feelings in a figurative style. For ordinary words will not convey the admiration, nor literal words the reverence which possesses it. And when, dazzled at length with the great sight, it turns away for relief, it still catches in every new object which it encounters glimpses of its former vision and colours its whole range of thought with this one abiding association. If, however, he continues, others have preceded it in the privilege of such contemplations, a well-disciplined piety will lead it to adopt the images which they have invented, both from affection for what is familiar to it and from a fear of using unsanctioned language on a sacred subject. And he goes on to say, surely in Revelation we would expect this. In other words, Mark, Matthew, Luke, John, Paul, Peter, behind the Gospel of Mark, when they're writing their history of Jesus, they're remembering the words he spoke. Oh, yes. They're remembering what he really did. Yes. But they're remembering it as they've lived it, prayed it, come to understand its significance, and they can't put it in ordinary words because they don't capture it. They want to capture the feeling of it and the immensity of it. And they find their language, and the language of the New Testament, the language of this history, is the sacred language of the Bible, of the Old Testament. The imagery they use, the figures that come to their mind, the Shekinah, the glory cloud, the imagination they've got, because of the sacred history of their language, they use those words to get across the real meaning of Jesus.